Hi, everyone, and welcome to the Content Sutra podcast. I'm here today for a very special episode. On the back end, we have Glenn Greenwald, the infamous investigative journalist for The Guardian, who wrote the Pulitzer Prize-winning series of stories on the NSA spying scandal, which was published a couple of years ago. And Dylan Baker, associate editor, is going to interview him for that. But first, we're going to discuss the future of investigative journalism with a couple of special guests, Sam Slaughter, our VP of content here at Contently, and the chairman of the Contently Foundation.
Thanks for having me, Joe.
And Brad Hamilton, the editor-in-chief of the Contently Foundation, which won the ASJA Award for Investigative Journalism last year after just 1 year of publishing. I'm also a famed investigative journalist for Playboy, for the New York Post. He started the first investigative journalism desk there, owns a very sexy lounge on Houston called Madam X. And Brad, we're super happy to have you here too.
Me too. Can't wait.
All right, guys, so let's just get this started. I mean, I think one big thing on everyone's mind is how do we keep investigative journalism going? What are the business models that can really be the future of this very important part of our democracy? And you guys have an interesting perspective because of your place at the Contently Foundation. And Shane, you want to hop in here? Sorry. Everyone, we got Shane Snow coming in late for the podcast. He's just going to join us here too on the round table. And so, yeah, so Sam, do you want to explain a little bit how the Contently Foundation got going, how Contently came to be funding a an investigative journalism nonprofit, considering we are a content marketing technology company?
Yeah, so I mean, I come from a journalism background and Shane comes from a journalism background also, and we kind of found ourselves not working as journalists. We sort of started Contently and it was a marketplace for journalists, and we thought it was an idea of a place for media companies to match up with freelancers. What it wound up being is like an enterprise software company that sells content marketing stuff, but we still kind of had this idea of investigative reporting and it being something that we cared about in the back of our minds. And we kind of had all, we worried that, you know, as publications were shedding jobs and sort of like janky digital first places were taking up a lot of the advertising dollars and airspace, that there wasn't really room for this kind of like long form reporting that we kind of grew up on and aspired to do and kind of were so impressed by. So, you know, we had sort of this cockamamie idea that we'd start a foundation, you know, using Contently profits to, you know, to do long form journalism, and brought it to the board of Contently, and the board was like, this is a great idea. And we were like, what? It is? And so, at that point, you know, I went out and I found Brad to come and sort of run the day-to-day of things, and we launched, and, you know, we just started publishing, and I think kind of our number one goal is really just to put out good work and to, you know, hold the powerful to account and comfort the afflicted, afflict the comfortable. And then I think we have this secondary goal, which is like sort of what you talked about, which is to prove out an alternative business model. It used to be only the New York Times or the Washington Post or whoever could do things like this. But now you sort of have these different nonprofits, you know, with The Intercept, with the Marshall Project, and with us, kind of trying to prove out alternative structures. And in my mind, like what we've done differently is that we've been funded not by foundation grant money, but by a grant from a for-profit corporation that's Contently. And I think that's something that I want to prove that is possible. I think a lot of people would have, you know, think that it's a little bit weird. But ideally our reporting kind of proves out that this, something like this can work.
Well, there's every year in America, there's something like $36 billion that gets given to corporate responsibility, which is basically Walmart planting trees in their neighborhood. And I really think that that's what this model is that corporations have a responsibility to give back to their communities. And a lot of them do this for PR or to so that people, you know, don't drive Walmart out of the community. But we saw as a company that cares about journalism, that's our company is mostly in the entertainment and education business, but we care about journalism. We saw investigative journalism as our way of being able to plant trees. And like Sam said, I think it's that something that other companies that care about their local communities can and should donate to you as part of that responsibility to the citizenship and to the place where they're operating.
Yeah, so Brad, was this super weird to you when Sam approached you?
I wouldn't say it was super weird. I'd say it was super fortuitous because I sort of, at the same time that they were having this idea, I was transitioning away from the New York Post, where I'd been for many years. And, you know, it's kind of like, I'm sort of like an example of what's happening to investigative journalism in that it is very expensive. It's an expensive thing to do. It takes time and money and expertise. And often you launch yourself into something that could go for weeks or even months and ultimately produce very little. So big media is getting away from that because, you know, there's a lot of restriction, you know, financial restriction in the market. And so it's sort of like the kind of thing that's easiest to get rid of, right? Because it's expensive and time consuming and it doesn't necessarily produce much ROI. So this creation, this project here that Contently came up with is great because it's very focused on long form. I don't have to spend my time fundraising because it's been funded by the Contently company. And it does exactly what long-form investigative journalism is supposed to do. It shines a light on problems.
What do you say, you know, I'm sure this happens to you and you have people being like, whoa, your, you know, investigative journalism, you know, project that you're running is funded by a technology company. How do you explain that and where the lines are and all that kind of stuff?
Well, in one way, it's not any different really from ProPublica or the Marshall Project. Those are funded by companies as well through those for-profit companies' foundations. So in essence, this is the same thing, only instead of a variety of funders, there's one.
And what do you think of Sam's theory that, you know, and Shane's theory that this can work on a larger scale? Can Walmart start giving its CSR dollars to investigative journalism?
There's no reason why not. I mean, the idea is that investigative journalism is something that is in the public good. It does help society at large, just like other things that big corporations give money to. And if it turns out that they see that there's a value for them to do that, then why not?
Brad, you may be the first investigative reporter I've ever heard use the term ROI before. Clearly, you've been spending too much time here.
Well, I think one of the important points is that in order for this to work with the partnership of corporations is the journalism project needs to be independent. There needs to be no influence for that ROI. You know, Walmart needs to not have any control over. And we're using Walmart just because they're a huge corporation. They're not doing this, right? But that company needs to have no control over what happens so that the trust of the public can remain intact, which is sort of our responsibility as journalists. And so the consideration of what is the return on this investment per story can't be part of the equation. The return on the investment for Walmart or whatever is that it makes them look good to the public. Like, it's the PR value of we're do-gooders, we care about, you know, the world and our community, but it can't be, we did this investigation on, you know, plastic toy makers or whatever, and now we're making bigger profits on the plastic we get. Like, that's,
yeah,
they shouldn't be mixing those worlds.
Right, whereas like traditional media, I mean, you could say like the Washington Post advertisers, right, are paying in some part for, you know, Woodward and Bernstein or whoever is now doing their projects. Those advertisers shouldn't be able to weigh in and say, you know what, you guys did a big probe into our industry and we don't like that, so therefore we're not going to advertise. There should be that wall. And there is. There is a wall, that wall here, and there should be in whatever model there is.
So, you know, there probably has to be limits on what topics a brand-funded investigative journalism outfit can go after. Like, if Walmart came out and they came out with a big expose of Amazon having dungeons in their basement with employees locked up in torture chambers, you know, everyone would be like, wow, this is an amazing story, but Walmart has an ulterior motive of making Amazon look really badly, bad for competitive reasons. And you guys have, like, those limits too, right?
Well, I mean, the mission when I came on here was one thing: produce good work. And that was pretty much it. We talk about the projects. The projects are, as you can see from our website, they are a variety of different subject matters. They're kind of all over the map. And for us, the important thing is to be able to find something that is in the public interest, find a problem, expose it, do a good job, tell a good story.
What other business model do you guys think could work for investigative journalism other than brands funding it?
One that's been attempted quite a bit is the crowdfunding model. And I think there's sort of pre and post crowdfunding. It's tough because you're asking a lot of people, and that funder is, so part of what, and Brad alluded to this, part of what makes this work is someone who's good at investigating corruption or, you know, stories, or being an investigative journalist and storyteller is not necessarily good at raising money. And those are two very different skill sets. And I think it's ludicrous to expect a great journalist to be also good at selling people on giving donations. And so that's where this works, is we can separate those skill sets. So the crowdfunding thing usually doesn't work very well because typically it's been an individual or a small outfit trying to do that Kickstarter campaign or Indiegogo campaign ahead of time. There's also sort of the post-publication crowdfunding model, which is essentially the Kindle singles or what the Atavist does. They will pay someone royalties, essentially. They'll say, we'll send you out to go investigate this story, then we'll publish it and we'll charge $1 a piece for everyone who reads it. And then you get paid that way. And sometimes places like the Atavist will give you an advance, sort of like a book, knowing that they will make some royalties back. But it's a tough model. So it's almost the traditional book publishing model where you sort of invest a little bit in the investigative story and then get the crowd to pay it back in $1 increments. But it's tough. It's expensive stuff.
And there's also Beacon, which is another new model, kind of like them, you know, Beacon out of San Francisco. What they'll do is they'll offer to the crowd that they're trying to raise money from, hey, we have a journalist who wants to spend a year focusing on this particular subject. If you're interested in that subject, you want to know more, give $1, $5, whatever. I mean, they did that with Shane, sort of famously with Shane Bauer a few years ago, the guy who had, one of the hikers that was in prison in Iran. He spent a year, however many years in Iran, in Iranian prison. When he got out, he wrote a book about it, and they wanted to focus for a year on the U.S. prison system. And so I think they raised something like $80,000 for him. So that kind of very specific project model can be, a useful platform for raising money.
And I think, there's also this idea that these sort of newer digital first organizations like BuzzFeed and Vice and Vox see some value in it, in terms of just, publishing great investigative work may not be a clear line to ad sales, but I think it's a dotted line to essentially customer trust and return visitors and things like that, which they can then monetize later. And I think that they've sort of, in fits and starts, like come to that, and in different levels of kind of like, the different levels of investment. But I do think that there's an understanding, like in the higher levels of some of those organizations, that this is something that is a long-term investment that will bear fruit financially for them, just not immediately, in the same way that, our list of 15 cat gifts will.
I think one thing that's promising is you see the New York Times exceeding a million digital subscribers and having strong growth there. See Blendl, which is this European startup that basically packages a bunch of different long-form journalism and investigative journalism and then sells it to their consumers. And their system's a little complicated, but basically they have a refund system. When things are seen of value by the readers, they can choose, they'll pay for it. If they feel like they got clickbaited or they chose to pay for something, they can ask for a refund. And so basically what they've seen over time is that people ask for refunds on clickbaity type articles, but if it's investigative journalism, they almost never ask for their money back because they see true value in it. And so the conclusion there is that, people are willing to pay for investigative journalism. That seems really promising. Do you think that there's like a subscription model that will last, or is that too dicey?
I don't think so.
Yeah, I think it's hard because when you write something and produce something, you don't know how many people are going to be interested in that particular subject. You could be surprised one way or the other, right? So in other words, if you're going to invest in something like this and sort of gamble that people will be interested in it, you have to do research in advance. And so then what you wind up doing is sort of skewing what projects you focus on by what you think the crowd will want. And then you're sort of in the same game as big media is in general. You know, it may not be clickbait, but it's essentially trying to test the waters and find out what the market is responding to. And that's sort of the antithesis of the basic model of investigative journalism, which is to say that, you know, you can pick up the New York Times or the New York Post or any major publication, and there's tons of stuff in there that's just sort of crowd-pleasing stuff. But then there's going to be the stuff that is going to require a little more investment from the reader. They're going to have to read longer. Right, and we know that that crowd of people who are interested in that is smaller. So that particular project in that particular publication is being funded by everything else that is sort of more moneyed and revenue oriented. So you want to kind of get away from that. And so I'm with Shane. I'm kind of dubious about whether that will work or not.
I think there's. I mean, it can work as a bigger part, as a piece of something larger. Like I don't think as the only way of funding something, it's got a lot of legs. But I think, you know, building that into the revenue model of a larger publication might make some sense. The other thing that I want to mention is, like, the other problem with that is, you know, a lot of times you spend a couple of weeks trying to track it down something that you think is a story and it's not. And that's just, I mean, that's essentially a sunk cost. And when it's a sunk cost of the publication's time or of your time as a journalist, that's one thing. If it's like a reader's sunk cost, they're not going to understand that. They're like, well, I gave you this money. Why you've returned me zero? And I think that there's a disconnect there too.
Yeah, and I think that maybe one of the reasons why this particular model that we're using and why, you know, there are a couple of other players in this field, the reason I think it's working is in essence, people generally know that there is societal good in having journalists look at problems, right? I mean, there's so many examples of big problems being exposed by journalists. And because there's less and less of that in big media, there's more and more concern that this kind of art is fading away a little bit. So I think corporations understand the value of it. And I think people who like this type of thing understand the value of it. So it's a matter of like matching these two things together.
I think one thing that could work is the trend of individual journalists and bloggers building their own brand and their own following. You're starting to see there's a company called Patreon, and there's a few others, Recurrency, and a few of these other subscription-based donation services where you can basically be a supporter of someone who, on a subscription basis, who's doing good work. So a friend of mine runs a popular blog called Wait But Why, which is sort of explainers about science, and it's really fun. And he has something like $10,000 a month in recurring donations from people who, over the last 3 years as he's built his blog, they love his stuff and they say, yes, I'll pay $1 a month to support this. So there's a lot of people that are supporting this. And then he does an awesome post every week. I think and it's because he's built this brand himself. It's just him. So his costs are really low. He's managed to do that. And if you think about journalists that have a good personal brand that can go from one publication to another and take their audience with them, they have a big mailing list, they can get traffic, there is a case for that potentially working for individual enterprising journalists. Someone who has a great reputation as an investigator could build their own following and say, I'm going to do one investigation every month. And maybe like Sam says, like some months, just a lot of, you know, threads dry up. Yeah, that's mixing metaphors, but a lot of things dry up. But there is potentially that, but the cost has to be really low. And that's why I don't think it can work at a sort of full-scale publication level for individual donations as nearly as well as it can for large lump donations from corporations and foundations.
I think that's interesting because it gets into almost a psychological element where people expect content on the internet to be free, but they don't expect you as a journalist to work for free. But people don't necessarily always make those connections between the two. But when it comes to funding someone who's writing, you know, you love, you trust, you're way more willing to give them money to support what they do.
And the Wait But Why example is a really good one, because that guy has built this following because he's such a strong writer. You know, he pours himself into the writing and he has a really strong voice and a big personality as well. So it doesn't necessarily have to be something where he's investigated, he spent 3 months looking into documents of some kind of whatever pollution issue or something like that. He's just basically covering whatever he wants to cover. And because he's such a good writer, people are keen to hear what he has to say.
What's also worrisome, though, with that model is, do we lose really good editing, which is so crucial to investigative journalism?
Yeah, well, that's for sure. I mean, that is an issue. I mean, as Sam knows, it takes us a long time to produce the stories that we produce.
And editing is, in my opinion, editing is really a lost art. Like, a good editor is so important and so hard to come by. I don't know. I do worry about that. I think, you know, especially for investigative work, but really for any kind of written work, it's like the impetus is to get things out so quickly. And no one really cares about the craft so much as it has like a headline. That kind of, this is a skill of the skill of like really taking a piece and finding out where it works and where it doesn't, what to add and what not to add, and where new reporting needs to be done. I think is like, it feels to me like there's fewer and fewer people that do it for a living. And I think that that's sort of unfortunate.
I mean, if you look at Bob Woodward, right, he's legendary, of course, everyone knows his name, probably one of the greatest investigative journalists of all time. He's not a very good writer, and so he needs editing. You know, everyone needs editing, but how are you going to do, if you have somebody like Bob Woodward, who's like a young person who can run off and gather all these documents, get all this information, but has trouble putting it together, or isn't a good storyteller. I mean, one of the things about what we're doing is they're long form, so that means you're talking about minimum 3,000 words. You know, we produce stories that were 8,000 words. If you're gonna get a reader to read 8,000 words, there has to be good storytelling. It has to be dramatic. You know, it has to draw them in and keep them interested in layers, in sections. So there's pacing involved in that. And it's, as Sam said, it's an art that sort of is fading, given that so much of what's happening in journalism is quick hitting, listy, you know, frothy, sexy, fast. It's the opposite of what this form is.
Yeah, what about that side of the talent pool too, young investigative journalists? Because right now you're coming up out of college, you say, I want to be in investigative journalism. People look at you like you're suicidal. You're never going to get a job. You're never going to make any money. At best, you're just going to end up at BuzzFeed toiling and, you know, writing listicles. Are you worried at all about a lack of talent coming up in investigative journalism?
I'm not worried about a lack of interest. There are a lot of people who are suicidal in that way, you know, and they see that there is the history of it. There's a great tradition. And whatever models wind up, you know, being sorted out and working in this industry will happen. The key is, if you, like Sam was saying, like if you know what you're doing, if you can actually get in there and start working and gathering information that no one else has, there will be a market for it. So one of the things we do with Contently is we work with young writers and young reporters, and some of them have never done long form before. So like, this is kind of a place for them to learn a little bit and work with us and sort of fine tune what they're doing. So, you know, and we're not the only place. So I think there is incubation instincts out there, and there are editors who want to work with young reporters. So I would say that because of the level of interest that I've seen, I'm encouraged by that.
Do you feel more optimistic now than you did 5 years ago about the future of investigative journalism?
Yeah, I do. I mean, I think that there's been a sea change, not a sea change, but I think that there's been this moving away from what we used to call marshmallow metrics, I guess. What is it that Paul calls them? Anyway, I think, you know, as sort of advertisers and business models move more towards this idea of attention versus kind of like page views and whatever other like surface things that they've been measured against, the actual money will start to flow into things that keep readers captivated for a really long time. And I think that investigative work is like one of the main things that does that as a publisher, that if you can publish something long form that's really got a good narrative and is important and people read and share and are interested in, I think there's a halo effect on everything else, all the other stuff that you publish. So I think in that sense, there's a lot of encouragement. I think that we have seen a lot of these different models for funding investigative reporting pop up, and we've seen them, some of them do like incredible work. ProPublica is one great example who's really like just reported, you know, I think they won a Pulitzer last year, like, and they're, you know, for reporting on things. And so, I don't know, I do think that there's a bright side out here the fragmentation of media has been problematic, but also, you know, there's these little fragments that pop up that do cool shit. And I think, you know, we're going to start to see more of that.
I also think that there's a chance that big media might reevaluate its decision to, you know, get rid of these people. You look at The Guardian, you're talking The Guardian later, right? So The Guardian, you ask them, what did their revelations, you know, their NSA stuff, what did that do for their brand? It redefined their brand, you know? So how much did it cost them? How much did it bring to them? It's sort of, that may be hard to define exactly in dollars and cents, but as far as like marketing what they do and who they are, I mean, that kind of success certainly changed the landscape for them.
That actually speaks to the history of investigative journalism. I give a talk about the history of publishing in general, and one of the things that I talk about in that speech is how during the newspaper wars of the 1800s, you had all these newspapers doing sort of commodity content, sensationalist headlines, and, you know, hiring the newspaper boys to yell the headlines out on the street corners. And none of these newspapers, you know, the New York World, the New York Journal, and the New York Times in the early days, they couldn't really get subscribers that subscribed to their brand that were loyal. They just got people who would pick up the headline of the day until they started hiring people like Nellie Bly to go and pretend to be insane and go get committed to an insane asylum and then report on the crazy conditions inside of the asylum and then get busted out and write this huge report. Things like that started happening in the 1800s, and that's how these newspapers differentiated themselves, which is essentially a branding and almost a public relations exercise. But by doing these longer form stories that were shining light on parts of the world that you didn't see, they were showing their expertise in journalism and gaining trust of people and then building subscribers. So that's why I think your point, Brad, is historical. And as people are more and more skeptical of the media or cynical of the media, and we have all these different, you know, I think cable news is causing a lot of problems there. People don't trust the media. I think this kind of work can help build trust. I think it's one of the reasons why the New York Times, the Washington Post, and the Guardian still have great reputations, despite most people, when you ask them, saying that the media is biased and all of these things.
Yeah. I mean, I can think of an example now that friends of mine who were in this know that when I start talking about this subject, many of them will bring up this investigative piece that the New York Times did about the nail salons in New York, because I think probably every female journalist in the city was kicking herself over, why didn't I do that story? And it was this great piece that was right there for everyone. And they had a reporter who did a great job with it, you know, looking into these horrendous conditions that exist behind the scenes. And so that, you know, that certainly also makes people feel better about the New York Times, makes people believe in the value of it and sees their integrity and gives them a measure of trust that wouldn't exist without that kind of a story.
That seems to almost bring us full circle, because we began by talking about brands building trust and credibility and, you know, good PR points for doing investigative journalism potentially. And really, there's a lot of that at play with media outlets as well. So as we wrap up this portion of it, I'd like to just get one hard prediction on the future of investigative journalism from each of you.
Mine's one that I've been saying for a little bit, and I heard it repeated by the chairman of the Marshall Project recently at a panel at Columbia Journalism School, that I think that in the near future, we're going to see most investigative journalism move to the nonprofit model, which sort of goes against what we've been saying. But I think we're going to start to see that, and perhaps the resurgence of investigative journalism as part of the brand building effort and the credibility for big newspapers. I want to see that happen, but I think we're going to see a lot of this kind of work shift to nonprofits and potentially even media companies putting their corporate responsibility money or putting their fundraising efforts towards these nonprofits who then they co-publish with. So, for example, the New York Times putting some money to sort of outsource the investigation to ProPublica and then republishing on the New York Times. I think we're going to start to see some of that sort of mixing of worlds occur in the not too distant future.
Yeah, I think he stole my thunder a little. I was going to say outsourcing and collaboration will be the two, to me, will be the two big watchwords in this industry. There will be media partners collaborating. Co-publishing is going to continue to exist. There will be an emergence of a further emergence of nonprofits, perhaps along the lines of what Shane was talking about earlier, where you have actually individuals who develop their own brand as investigators, who then resell their work, offer for free what they have to bigger media outlets. Bigger media outlets then responding like, "Oh, this is good. We should have done this." And then perhaps that might re-energize big media as far as investing their own resources.
Yeah, I think we're going to see a brand that gives money to a foundation that does this wind up getting investigated and getting busted doing something they shouldn't be doing. And it's going to be great for the shareholders of the company, and it's going to be great for, you know, the people that are inside the company that, you know, actually care about performance and want to see sort of like the bad apples exposed. And everyone's going to have a big outcry, and then they're going to think about it and be like, "Oh, wait, this is actually like really useful stuff. Like every company should have a journalist like poking around at the ill shit that they do."
I think another prediction is that there's going to be a debate not too long from now about whether a brand that has funded some sort of great piece of journalism should be even in the running for a Pulitzer. Someone's going to get nominated. People are going to freak out and argue just like they did with Huffington Post and every kind of newfangled journalism outfit that does something Pulitzer worthy. We're going to see that argument with a brand in the mix not too far from now.
Now, we do predictions every year, and you guys have been pushing this a brand winning a Pulitzer prediction for like 2 years now. Do you think 2016 is when it finally happens?
I don't think anybody is really claiming that a brand is going to win a Pulitzer, but I do think that Shane, like, that something like that will come up for debate and people will be pissed off. That I actually can guarantee that something will happen with this side of journalism that will piss people off. That's ironclad.
That's a very ironclad prediction. The one thing I think is going to happen that we haven't talked about too much here is that I do think the business model of how ads are bought and sold on the internet is going to change enough to encourage more investment in investigative journalism. So we're already seeing The Economist and The Financial Times sell ads based on time and not based on impressions, which is a huge move. It means that long form is going to have a lot more value on these sites. And so I think that's going to be one factor. It's not going to be the factor, because I think we're all in agreement that there is no one magic business model that saves investigative journalism. But I think that is going to help justify, you know, the investment in it, is that it will be, they will be able to monetize it better than they are right now. And that'll be, you know, maybe the 10% or the 15% that helps get us there. All right, guys. Well, thank you for joining this segment of the podcast. Do you have any parting words for our listeners out there?
Happy holidays. Thanks for having us on the podcast. Thanks for listening. It's been great. It's real hot in this room.
Sorry I was late.
Check out Contently.org.
Everyone check out the Contently Foundation, Contently.org. There's some amazing investigative journalism up there. And up now, we have a pre-recorded interview with our young, ambitious associate editor, Dylan Baker. You heard him on our first episode of this podcast, talking with Glenn Greenwald about investigative journalism, freelancing, and the future of everything. So we're going to take it to there.
First off, do you think it's possible financially and otherwise to even like be a freelance investigative journalist anymore? I talk to a lot of people who say, you know, you can only do it if you have the backing of a media company or a nonprofit or what have you. So do you think it's possible in today's media climate?
It's definitely very difficult, and it'll likely be a struggle for a while. But I do think it's possible, and I think that for two reasons. Number one is that there are a lot of new media companies that are very well funded, and as a result, they're really aggressively competing with one another for high quality content. So if you're a freelancer who's just kind of producing, you know, trite hot takes or things that are easily replicated elsewhere, you know, there probably isn't going to be much of a competition to pay you a decent amount of money for what you're producing. But if you're actually producing something unique and high quality, there are a lot of new media organizations around with a lot of money and looking for, you know, really good stories. And that has made, I think, being a freelancer much more viable. Mm-hmm. And the second part of it is, you know, what I related to what I just said, which is, I mean, the internet, internet journalism in a lot of ways is a meritocracy in the sense that if you can produce something that other people aren't producing, you're going to be able to get a lot of people interested in what you're doing. And on the internet, if you have a lot of people interested in what you're doing, that can translate and often does translate into, you know, decent compensation, if not better. So, I mean, I think the challenge for a freelancer is to figure out what they can contribute that is actually unique and really making a difference.
Mm-hmm. And you think there can be advantages to being independent because maybe you don't have the same kind of editorial pressures or business pressures that staff writers might have?
I think there are huge benefits, and in fact, in every single writing position that I did in my career, I always did it freelance. I never joined the staff, even when I had, you know, a regular ongoing relationship like with Salon and The Guardian. I retained my freelance status in part to retain my independence, so that nobody could tell me when to write or what to write about or how to write, and also so that I was free always to, you know, go other places and use other platforms to convey the things I thought needed to be conveyed. So I think there's a huge benefit in retaining a freelance status, which is that you are a lot more independent. You have a lot more autonomy journalistically. The downside, of course, is that you have less security and stability as well. But again, if you find a way to position yourself as somebody who is, you know, of value to a lot of media organizations, I think that can be overcome, and then the benefits easily outweigh the costs.
Right. So this kind of touches on what you were talking about earlier with internet journalism. But there's kind of this general narrative that mainstream media companies are doing, you know, they care less and less about investigative work, while nonprofits and like venture-backed companies like The Intercept or even BuzzFeed are kind of picking up the slack. Do you agree with that? And what do you think that means for the future of investigative work, if that's true?
I do think that I think for a long time the you know, kind of piety about internet journalism was that it was killing long form investigative journalism because it placed such a premium on, you know, lots of quantity, not very in depth, clickbait worthy stuff that would just generate traffic, and that all came at the expense of long form investigative journalism. And I think if you look at what a lot of new media organizations are doing, I mean, I think BuzzFeed is probably the best example, just because they were reputed for so long to be the kind of, you know, epitome of just all the worst things about new media journalism that came at the expense of real investigations. And yet, you know, they devote a lot of money to a lot of great journalists who go around the world and report on really complex, deep stories. In a really substantive way, you know, and a lot of them don't produce anything for weeks or even a couple months at a time. That's the luxury that they have because of how well-funded they are and how well they're doing.
Right.
And, you know, I think you see that at other places, too. And, of course, I mean, The Intercept is, you know, geared exclusively to that. I mean, we're a little bit different because we don't really have revenue pressures because of how we're funded. So we have a lot of, you know, young writers on staff who maybe produce five or six pieces, not a day or a week or a month, but a year. And I think that you're seeing more and more of that because to be truly competitive on the internet, if all you want to do is like just produce a lot of traffic and don't really care about, you know, how much reader loyalty you have or how much each individual post generates, you just want to have good overall traffic statistics. Like, I would put Vox in that category. Then you don't really have to care about how much deep investigative journalism you're doing. You just tell your writers, you know, produce 8 to 10 posts a day, and the only metric by which we evaluate you is traffic. But I think a lot of other sites are looking to other metrics besides just the immediate gratification of clicks. Mm-hmm. And they realize that their long-term branding and long-term sustainability depends on their producing high-impact journalism stories that last for more than 4 hours. And I think that's really good news for young writers and for freelance writers who want to do real journalism.
Totally. And what do you think of like nonprofit organizations? I think the main one that people always talk about is the Marshall Project. And I actually heard him speak recently. He said that he thinks that's the future of investigative journalism. Would you agree with that? And what do you think of nonprofits like that?
I'm a little reluctant to say there's like the future of investigative journalism. I mean, that's definitely one promising model, and they're doing great things, the Marshall Project is. But, you know, BuzzFeed is another model, and they're the opposite of nonprofit. They're very for-profit, and they're producing a lot of great journalism as well. And then we're kind of a hybrid because, you know, because we just happen to find a very well-resourced funder who believes in the journalism that we're doing and is willing to back it. You see that in other places too. And I think there's reader-supported journalism that has a real future on the internet as well. So I don't see any, like, I wouldn't say there any one model is the model for how investigative journalism can work. But I do think that looking at journalism as a public service, which is ultimately what, you know, nonprofit status is about, or finding, you know, a rich person or a series of rich people who support the journalism you're doing, that is a really promising model. Because ultimately, journalism, when it's done right, is a public service and should be supportive in the same way that, like, say, charities are, or hospitals, or, you know, artists throughout history have been, with patrons and the like. It contributes to society in really important and indispensable ways, and I think people are starting to realize that more and more.
Totally. And that actually goes along with my next question, which is, what do you think of, like, companies and like brands funding investigative work like they would other charitable work? Do you think there's like maybe is that dangerous, or do you think that's promising?
It is dangerous for all the obvious reasons, which is that funders might want to attach strings to the work that you do. But you know, the same is true of sites that are funded by advertisers.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, BuzzFeed has had several pretty serious, you know, I don't know if it rises to the level of scandal, but certainly controversies where it seemed like at least a lot of people believe they, you know, catered the content of their journalism to please advertisers or to avoid displeasing them. So I think there's dangers in all the models that we've been talking about. Obviously, getting funders, you know, you might even subconsciously want to avoid doing things to alienate your funders. But even reader-supported sites. I know when I was reader supported for a long time, you know, there were several occasions when I knew what I was writing was going to alienate a large segment of my readership. And of course, you have that thought, like, you know, should you do this? Because they're the ones ultimately funding you and enabling you to do it. And I think ultimately you have to remember why you went into journalism and realize that the only way you're going to be a valuable journalist is if you follow your passion and preserve your journalistic integrity, which means never compromising what you think or say because of money. And the minute you start compromising what you think or say because of money, you're going to be like some shitty Politico columnist or something.
Right.
And so, you know, if you want to avoid falling to the level of Politico, which I think every decent person by definition does, you have to be willing to alienate even the people who are funding you. And most of all, you know, negotiate from the very start with whoever funds you your full and absolute right to have journalistic independence. Like, never let anybody interfere with the things you want to do and say. That's the number one rule for everything.
Cool. So I guess a final question here. Like, what kind of general advice would you give to young journalists, whether they're freelancers or not, who are hoping to break into the investigative field?
So what I would say is, in the first instance, is, you know, be a little bit willing to sacrifice some short-term work for longer-term benefit, by which I mean, I know this is really hard to do if you're trying to pay rent and having difficulty, but, you know, instead of taking every single job you can and just turning out copy in order to get, you know, $250 checks here and there, to try and, you know, work in a more substantive way so that what you're producing is more geared to quality rather than quantity. And I think the most important thing is to avoid being a generalist, like trying to just be willing to, don't be willing to write about every single topic, because no person can be well-versed in every topic. And if you write about stuff in which you're not well-versed and in which you don't really have expertise, you're going to just turn out very kind of mediocre, you know, product. And that's going to affect how you're perceived in the long run. So I think it's so critical to figure out what you're really passionately interested in And, you know, there's a market for everything. I mean, there's a huge internet out there. So topics that seem really obscure can definitely, if you do it the right way, generate enough attention and interest to sustain you and maybe even push you beyond that. And so I think it's critical to just pick a few topics in which you have a great deal of passion and develop genuine expertise in those so that what you're producing can't be found anywhere else except from you.
Great. Yeah. I think that's all I got. I was trying to keep
Excellent.
It short for you. Do you have anything else to add?
Yeah, those are great questions. I had to actually think about pretty much all of them. So